welcome to the Final Draft Books and Writing on 2SER. I'm Genevieve McGregor. Tonight we're exploring the wonderfully sinister world of crime fiction. Hitmen, cops, crims, and even a bit of comedy. When holidays come around in my family, a stack of crime novels is purchased and handed around like popcorn. But most of the time we are drawn to the international fare. Dominated for a long time by the Brits, we cut our teeth on Agatha Christie and then moved on to the proper novels of P.D. James. We now devour Donna Leon's Venetian Brunetti series, the Swedish Henning Mankell novels, or Stieg Larsson books. But what about Aussie fiction? Well, today we'll be hearing about two authors who draw on our criminal pasts and our habit of dreaming up larger-than-life bad guys. First up, we hear from Derek Hansen, who manages to mix comedy, hitmen, $3 million, and a small drought-ravaged town in his novel A Man You Can Bank On. We'll hear from writer Ross Gibson, who spent 5 years in the attic of the Justice and Police Museum, filtering through 500,000 crime scene negatives from the 1940s and 50s. And later in the show, we are moving beyond small-town crims to the number one international man of mystery himself, when we learn about the latest James Bond installment by Jeffrey Deaver. All coming up on the Final Draft, but first, Blood Buzz Ohio by The National to ease us into it.
I'm on a love buzz.
When's the last time you read an all-Australian comedy crime caper? Author Derek Hansen thought it had been far too long. He cooked up a story about a drought-ravaged country town called Moonee Moonee. The residents find $3 million buried by robbers, and their bank manager uses it to re-establish the town on solid economic grounds. But the criminals are out of jail and they want the money. The cops want the money, and two of Australia's most notorious hitmen are hot on the trail. Final Draft's Neda Vanovac speaks to Derek Hansen about the value of violence, the effects of comedy, and basing a character on Nettie Smith.
I wanted a bank manager who was treated as poorly by his bank as banks normally treat their customers. He's a rural bank manager, his branch is closed, he's replaced by a computer at the age of 50. He believes with all his potential untapped. He's living in a little town that's dying. He thinks the only thing that's going to mark his existence will be his gravestone. And it won't mark his existence so much as his passing. And the town manages to appropriate $3 million.
Well, you say appropriate. Somebody else might say steal.
Steal, all right. They managed to steal $3 million, which were the proceeds of another crime. The people in the country, salt of the earth. I wanted them in a way blameless for what they did, even though they committed a crime. No one's going to invest in a small town in the middle of a drought, so they needed an infusion of someone else's money. But how could they get that infusion any other way except by winning the lottery or by crime? But I wanted the crime to be victimless. Now, it doesn't give too much away about the plot if I tell you the robbers stole from bookies. Now, is that a crime? In Australia, that would not be considered a crime. People would have a great deal of sympathy with the robbers if they're robbing bookies. And then for the town to rob the robbers who robbed the bookies, that's not a crime either. I mean, you're stealing from thieves. How can that possibly be a crime? Technically, it is. And so I've got to have a cop that goes there who's so proper. I want the readers to be sympathetic towards the town. Now, Lambert gets hold of this money and he realises here is an opportunity to use the potential that the bank never allowed him to use and that the bank abandoned. And he sets his whole life on using marketing, his entrepreneurial nature, to get this town back on his feet.
I understand that the idea for A Man You Can Bank On came about in Guatemala, is that correct?
Yeah.
About as far from Moonee Moonee as one could get.
I had an idea that I wanted to do a crime story. I wasn't quite sure how it was going to work. I wanted the triumph of the little guy. This was just after the GFC when the little guys all got hurt. But I couldn't make it work. And I was in Guatemala. We're on a game fishing boat and went ashore for supplies. So anyway, we piled into this microbus. When I say microbus, seven of us managed to fit into something that a family of four in Australia would struggle to fit into. And we drove to the town. We got into the main street, which was very narrow. Traffic was blocked and we couldn't move. And all of a sudden, somebody stole something off the store and the Guatemalan police set off. And it's Keystone Cop stuff. Cops pushed a lady off a bike, grabbed the bike and were chasing the thief on her bicycle. Everyone's killing themselves laughing. And I turned around and I suddenly became aware that a consignment of money was being delivered by armed guards to the bank. They had a couple of guys going point with huge automatic weapons. A couple of guys carrying the strong box, and then the last guard had a weapon, the largest weapon I've ever seen, like it was off the set of Alien. This guy was wearing a uniform that was far too big for him. His trouser cuffs overlapped his shoes. Suddenly all the shouting started. He thought they were under attack. So he turned around and what he saw was us. And they jammed in their little microbus and he figured out we were the aggressors, that we were attacking them. And he turned around and he charged our bus. And all I could see was this kid tripping on his trouser cuffs and discharging his weapon. He's only 3 metres away from us. I was frozen. I couldn't move. I couldn't say anything. Even if I'd shouted to the guys, drive, drive, there's nowhere we could go. We were jammed. I learnt then that when guns are pointed at you, there are no heroics. All this stuff about when you read in crime novels about people wresting guns from their assailants or dodging bullets, forget it. But again, that just reinforced this belief that every crime novel I'd ever read had lied to me, and had lied wholesale. And I took that back on board, and if you know anything about game fishing, it's hours of boredom punctuated by moments of frenzied activity. And in those hours of boredom, I sat there and I thought, what have I learned from this? Here I am trying to write a crime novel, and I've discovered how fearsome, how frightening, how terrifying, how immobilizing it is to have a gun pointed at you. And I decided that every character in my book will be scared of guns, and with every right. Every character in my book would be very aware of what a gun could do to them. And from that realization seemed to open to me doors for humor. And I thought, if I can build on that, if I can then have the violence that everybody expects in a crime novel, and if I can take that violence and make an integral part of that violence some humor that the audience is privy to and can see coming, I want to deliver violence in a way that makes people laugh. So you're reading a story that is not only tense, that not only has you on the edge of your seat, out of left field comes a laugh. So I wanted to use my humour in a very Australian way and try and use Australian characters. I've got two hitmen, for example. These guys have an amazing work ethic.
Could you describe Irish and the Bowler for our listeners who may not be familiar with this very eclectic cast of characters?
Well, Irish and the Bowler are very intense, psychopathic killers. I've put them down as Australia's most notorious hitmen. In order for them to work in the novel, they also had to be an inadvertent comedy duo. Now, Irish got his nickname Irish because he always shot people three times.
To be sure.
And the Bowler, who liked trying to find imaginative ways of executing people, he liked to be creative in his work. He's very professional and very creative about the way he goes things. And in one instance, he used bull to dispose of one of his victims by pinning him to the ground and then lobbing the 1 kilogram bowling ball at him, and you know, gradually worked his way through the various parts of his body till he killed him. And that's how he got the nickname the Bowler.
So when you're writing a character like the Bowler, does the nickname come first and then the executing, or is it the other way around?
Well, I generally sit in a comfortable chair overlooking Pittwater, and I have a beer or a very good coffee, and I think about the character, and I keep thinking about the character till he amuses me, until I really get an image of what he should look like. In this instance, I based the Bowler on Nettie Smith. I went to a lunch, an ALP lunch, because I used to work on the advertising for the ALP, and this was a lunch before the election, it's a tradition, and they were a little surprised, I gathered, when Nettie Smith, Tom Domican and a few other more notorious characters showed up.
Staunch ALP supporters.
Staunch ALP supporters. And they were put on the table directly opposite us. We were irrelevant to Nettie Smith. He was like RoboCop in a way. His kind of eyes turned to look at us and the head followed. And he looked at us, unblinking, this sort of dead fish stare. Quite unnerving. I certainly felt like a child in the company of men. He was a man's man, make no mistake. And there was no mistaking the depth, what can I say, the deadness in his eyes. You're sitting opposite someone for lunch. I was fascinated by him. I wanted to stare at him. I wanted to store his character up for later use. And it's very difficult because the last thing I wanted to do was provoke him, but I got a pretty good look at him and I thought, when I was working on character for the Bowler, Nettie Smith came to mind. Now, how do you make a very unfunny guy humorous? I had to make him slightly dumb. And one day while sitting in the skin specialist's waiting room, there was a copy of Reader's Digest. There's always a copy of Reader's Digest there.
And in the waiting rooms of hell, there will be a copy of Reader's Digest.
You go to a physio, you go to a doctor, you go to a specialist, Reader's Digest is always there. And I flicked through and I found this thing, like how to improve your vocabulary. And it occurred to me, wouldn't it be great if you've got a guy who's a psychopathic killer who's into self-improvement and trying to improve his vocabulary. And I realised then that I could make Irish the straight man to my Nettie Smith clone, the Bowler, to his attempts at sophistication. I'd have the straight man. I've got the basis there of a comedy duo, albeit they're violent. People, when they read crime novels, they expect a certain level of violence. They expect dirty deeds to be done. But to then have an inherent comedy, something that the reader is privy to, something that the reader knows that because of the very interaction between these two characters, there is going to be humour there, that they can actually wait for it while they're reading, be caught up in the drama and the tension, but there's going to be a laugh.
That was author Derek Hansen speaking to Final Draft's Neda Vanovac. And this evening we're taking a walk on the wild side of crime fiction. Up next we talk to Sydney-based writer Ross Gibson about his fascination with the darker side of this fair city of ours. And his novel The Summer Exercises came about from quite a different route than most novels. Gibson spent 5 years in the attic of the Justice and Police Museum filtering through 500,000 crime scene negatives from the 1940s and 50s. Beside the images, Gibson constructs the story of a civilian chaplain attached to the Central Street Police Station during the summer of 1946, recording his impressions of the crimes, detectives, and the city that fascinates and corrupts him. Gibson spoke to me about what started him off into the sordid noir world of Sydney post-war.
I've been working for a long time as a historian of Sydney, so I've always been interested in the forces that move through this place that we think we know well. I got to look at this archive of crime scene photos, and they're just astonishing, disturbing, wondrous, problematic. And the other thing about them is that they actually don't have any conclusive documentation with them. All of the court reports and the judgments that you would think would be with them, the details about the cases, they've all gone missing. So all you've got are these photographs that have just a little bit of detail, a date, a location around town, the photographer's name, and the photographer's guess at what the case is probably going to be about. And that's enough to get you started, but you have to accept straight away that you're never going to reach the bottom of it.
So tell me about the images. What drew you to them?
For me, firstly, this is my town, Sydney, and Sydney is very particular, but Sydney is also like a lot of generic post-World War II towns that have been taken over by the car and taken over by big capital. And so you can look very closely at this very special place, but also you can get an understanding of global tendencies in social and cultural history. So that drew me to it. But mostly what drew me to it is the pictures are kind of, they've got this sort of concussion in them. Something's happened recently in each of these pictures, and you've just got to work your way back. You know, you think of fiction as a whole lot of prospective and projective activity, where if this happened, what would happen next? But what's so interesting about the forensic narrative is, well, this has already happened. How do we work backwards to figure out what might have got us to that point, where we're now in the aftermath of that point? So how powerful they are narratively, but also how poignant they are, you know, how these ordinary places, corners that everyone in who's walked around the CBD or the inner city of Sydney, everyone stood on these corners, but deep cosmic things have happened there.
Yeah.
And so that's what drew me to them. Mm. And there's thousands and thousands of images, of course, and over about 5 years I scooped up about 400 particular images, most of them that are striking pictorially, but some of them that just have a quality in them even though they're very banal. And that 400 made a world somehow, and I started to know that world really intimately.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to figure out, well, who lives in this world? What happened? There's a larger story that starts to emerge. And so that's how the novel idea started to come through.
Okay. And, I mean, often the scenes look very ordinary, like a single bed, an open window. There's a man and a dog. The Cooper on the stick was just the front image.
Mm.
They don't look like crime scenes. There's a mystery to them, I suppose, and a starkness. Was that something that drew you to them?
Definitely the starkness. And there's a reason for that, technically. The police, when they take the photos, they flood the picture with light because they know they've got to go into court and every detail in the scene has to be accessible. And so they're already quite striking because you look at them and think, oh, that's like 1940s film noir. But it's not, because film noir is all about the shadow and these are about elimination of shadow, and that's where you get the starkness.
Mm.
Also the ordinariness of them, how there are lots of scenes where if you weren't told that this was a crime scene, you'd just see it as someone taking banal snapshots. But as soon as you know it's a crime scene, that it's an aftermath of some shift in social or cosmic order. Someone's mm. luck went wrong or some violence happened. As soon as you know that frames around it, all of the narrative floods into it and out of it.
I mean, the images don't talk directly to the text. I found they often took a different story, and I couldn't go past an image without looking it up, the caption at the back.
Uh-huh.
What was the effect of having the photos in the text?
I mean, your response is a good one, and one I'm really pleased about. There's lots of different readers, I imagine, the people who want to march through a narrative, the people who will just inevitably flick through the photos for 3 or 4 hours and disregard the words, but then may come to the words.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the more, you're the kind of investigator. You know, you get very caught in the idea. You start in the idea of the image and start to chase it, and then you want to know some details. So I wanted to design the piece for all of those types of readers. And the other thing, I guess, sort of interesting about it is I wrote this narrative that's originally 110,000 words, you know, a standard Dickensian kind of narrative. He said, she said, they went there, they thought this. And I just thought, I'm not interested in it, and it's too full. And so then I went back and did this exercise of pulling about 75,000 words out, and so that all you've got left is this roughly 30, 33,000 words. And it's kind of resonating, I hope, with everything that's missing.
I mean, in some ways it interrupted the written narrative a bit, having to go back. But in other ways it made the story sort of many stories running together. Was that the idea?
Yeah, well, I wanted, one of the readers I wanted was the detective or the investigative sort of personality. And mm-hmm. I became that. You know, I've got to know detectives, and I realise, you know, if the cards had fallen differently, I could well have gone into the cops and become a detective. And there are lots of people like that. And what you do is, as a detective, is you just get this very broad, seemingly unsystematic knowledge of a region and of people. And it just gets thicker and thicker with experience. And then single events start to occur, and you draw on your experience to make sense of it. And that's kind of what you're doing when you're finding this image, having all of these ideas and emotions in response to it. And then you go over to the research information, and you're thickening up your knowledge all the time.
Just to get back to Sydney post-war, I mean, you painted this sort of sordid and quite dark world in the book. Can you tell me a little bit about Sydney post-war?
Sydney post-war, well, firstly, Sydney war. Sydney wartime was a wild place, and a quite kind of open and lascivious place. At the same time, it was, everything was clamped down. There were brownouts. You weren't allowed to have lights on in the nighttime, and so on. And there were rations everywhere, restrictions. But within that, there was this sense of urgency. Like, most of the men have gone. The men who are in town are these strangers who have come in. The women are caught here. Death is close by. You might get news of family members dead. So everything's very, very charged. And so there was a lot of really urgent pleasure being taken. And that didn't die down afterwards. I mean, the war finishes, law and order comes back in, the lights go on again. But a significant proportion of the people had got used to the other way of enjoying. And then at the same time as that happens, you're getting the reconfiguration of Australian economics. You know, America starts to come in and control Australian economics. The car starts to take over the town. So it's this town that's under enormous pressures.
And you seem to play with the opposites of the intense light and the heat of Sydney in summer, and the other side, which the detectives and then the chaplain, obviously, are witness to. What do you think it is about Sydney that attracts that dark side?
First thing, how did Sydney get started? Military invasion, land-grabbing mayhem, 1788 and onwards, you know. So that's never gone away. So there's all of those dark forces underneath our shiny town. And that was what I was very interested in showing.
And why a chaplain?
You know that most of those kind of forensic narratives have some quester, someone who just goes in procedurally and then gets hooked at a more metaphysical level. And I always am interested in those functionaries. It's usually a detective. Sometimes it's a private eye. Sometimes it's a insurance investigator. And I just thought, well, a chaplain is kind of interesting too, because they're going in with a job to do, but the metaphysical level is going to kick in very quickly. And then if you get the physical level as well, if the chaplain is not shiny, is not super clean, you know, is starting to recognize appetites and pursuing appetites, then you get the kind of complexity that writers like to wrangle.
Ross Gibson there, speaking with me about his novel The Summer Exercises, which was published by the University of Western Australia Press. You're listening to The Final Draft on 2SER, and before we go this evening, I want you to consider what it would be like to step into the shoes of one of the best-known writers of one of the most enigmatic protagonists and products on the planet. Internationally acclaimed crime writer Jeffrey Deaver was commissioned by Ian Fleming's estate to write the latest James Bond novel. With a few updates in the present day, while still retaining touches of classic Bond, the book is a page-turning thriller in Deaver's recognisable style. Final Draft's Neda Vanavak met up with Jeffrey Deaver last week and checked out the book for us on its Australian release.
Although his creator Ian Fleming passed away in the 1960s, James Bond lives on, and he's back for a new adventure. After winning the Ian Fleming Silver Dagger Award for one of his novels, internationally acclaimed crime writer Jeffrey Deaver was approached by the author's estate to tackle a new Bond novel, and he told me he debated for all of 5 seconds before jumping on board. A longtime fan of James Bond, Deaver was reading about his international spy capers at the impressionable age of 8. It seemed quite natural then for him to step into Fleming's shoes and write his own story. Carte Blanche is the fifth in a series of new Bond books commissioned by Fleming's estate. Kingsley Amis and Sebastian Faulks have previously written Bond novels, but Diva's offering ramps up the action to the modern day while still retaining a touch of the original literary Bond. Diva's knight-errant has undergone a few key changes. He's younger, in his early 30s. In a post-9/11 world, he's a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. He's been recruited to a new organisation that operates independently of M15, M16 and the Ministry of Defence, and he uses an IQ phone loaded with spy apps to help him hunt down his foes. The classic Bond elements, though, are still firmly in place. Pathological villains, expensive cars, overt product placement and the pun-laden, hilariously named femme fatales. The book has all the hallmarks of a Jeffrey Diva thriller, key, he said, to giving his fan base a story in a style they would recognise. He told me there's a Diva formula that his readers expect. Multiple subplots, twists and turns, and big surprise ending followed by a big surprise ending followed by yet another big surprise ending. Why have one when you can have three or four? The new James Bond is hunting down the instigators of Incident 20. Some kind of terrorist act is going to cause thousands of casualties. The villains are using Greenway, a waste disposal company, as a front, and there are murmurings of action coming out of Afghanistan. Bond is hot on the trail from Serbia to Cape Town via England and Dubai over the course of a week as he unravels the plot, grappling with interagency bureaucracy as he tries to prevent large-scale civilian deaths. With 100 million Bond books estimated to have sold over the past 60 years and over a billion people thought to have seen a Bond film, Diva had big shoes to fill. The James Bond legacy is now led by the movies rather than its books, as the franchise keeps pace with modern audiences, and Diva felt a large responsibility not to mess up Bond despite ignoring the films entirely while writing. "I want people to like him," he said. "I want the readers to be on Bond's side, and to do that, you have to make him likable." James Bond is, after all, a complex character. Says Diva, "He's morally unambiguous when it comes to his mission, and his mission is to protect people. He performs that function with style, flair, with a sense of humour. He's also sophisticated. He likes the nicest things in life, but he doesn't like them for the sake of indulgence. He's a man who lives on the edge. He knows he'll be dead by the age of 45, and he's not going to live a Spartan life without experiencing what he can." A notable update has been the role of women in Bond's life. Diva argues that although Fleming had been repeatedly accused of misogyny and sexism, he was just responding to social norms of the time. A lot of Fleming's femme fatales were criminal masterminds in their own right. "I don't have Bond girls in my book," Diva said. "I have Bond women. Bond only responds to powerful women." From fellow agent Ophelia Maidenstone to the seductive Felicity Willing, Diva has had a lot of fun naming female characters who more than hold their own against the force that is James Bond. Despite the extended action sequences that the films are known for, Diva has stayed true to the books by creating a psychological thriller. As in Fleming's stories, the villain is known from the beginning, but it continues as a chase. Bond engages his opponents on a mental level, with violence sparing but effective. "Overuse of violence does a disservice to the reader," Diva said. "You don't want to desensitize them. Rather, you want to threaten your protagonist by putting the things they care about in danger." James Bond for the modern day isn't an amoral assassin. In the hands of Jeffrey Diva, he's a sympathetic guy with a bag full of tricks, looking for a meaningful connection. However, as the book quotes Rudyard Kipling, he travels fastest who travels alone. And to keep the stories alive, that may just be the fate of James Bond.
That was Final Draft's Neda Banovac and her review of the new James Bond novel by Jeffrey Diva. And that's all we have time for this evening. Tonight's show was dreamed up and executed with criminal mastermind excellence by Neda Banovac. Next week, we are dedicating the show to the birthday of the Einstein of Britain, engineer, physicist and inventor of the bra, Mr. Paul Dirac. On the Corner is up next, so stay tuned.